Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Attorney General Josh Call is running for a third term, not for governor. Plus, a Waukesha County judge says the state will need to verify the citizenship status of millions of voters. And lawmakers continue to spar over the administrative rules process. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for October 10th.
I'm Anuvin Wagnadonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome back to Rewind, J.R. A big announcement this week. We were kind of waiting to hear what Attorney General Josh Call was going to do. Was he going to run for governor? And he announced this week, no, he is going to seek a third term as Attorney General.
Yeah, so some people are like, why would he do this? He was even the front runner. Well, the simple answer is, didn't want the job. So let's kind of back up to Call. Look, as this field's growing for Democrats in the governor's race, you talk about lanes, right? You know, like the liberal lane, the moderate lane, the Madison lane. Well, Call would be kind of the guy who's won statewide twice lane, had more money in the bank lane. Like, he's got a lot of things going for him. Now, some would argue his name, and he's not that high on the attorney general. There are a few attorneys general have used that office very well to build their name ID, Call included. Jim Doyle, many moons ago, used it very well to build a stepping stone to become governor. Most, though, don't really kind of go around the state doing things the way they could to build name ID. Still, you know, Call, you'd go, okay, front run fits in. So there's some people like, why would you not jump in? How could you not take that opportunity? Well, I don't think he wants to be governor. Like, that's my kind of impression of my conversations. And in his announcement, he says, one, he's worried about his family. You know, he's got two young kids, I think 8 and 11. And two, who's been the next attorney general, because he wants the things, these fights he started with the Trump administration to carry through. So he's stepping out. Now he's going to run for re-election. You probably say, okay, incumbent, likely a good year for Democrats in 26. Not guaranteed, but probably in the White House, you know, kind of thing. Usually the party in power struggles. So you add those things up, he's probably a favorite for re-election as AG. And now that he's not in the race for governor, here comes Mandela Barnes, former lieutenant governor, U.S. Senate candidate, who is talking about running. Will he become the front runner if he gets in the race, which I'm the bet is he will. The question is when, because he ran in 2022. He raised a lot of money. I think he raised like 40-some million dollars for his campaign in 2022. Great fundraising list, a reservoir of support amongst the liberals in the base of the Democratic primary. So he might be your front runner. We'll see. But that's kind of like the scene that's been set now in the Dem primary for governor because Call's not in.
Right. There was sort of that open question because Call has been involved in so many lawsuits against the Trump administration. I think more than 30 legal actions of some kind. And so he told me that he wants to sort of stay in that lane of the fight. But certainly there could be sort of an advantage to anybody who can get into the governor's race and doesn't have to define this is who I am to most of the state, as many of the current Democratic candidates have to. So definitely it's still a pretty wide open race on the Democratic side. A couple of other little sort of election notes as well. Robin Voss said this week that he is considering not running for re-election. He's obviously the very powerful Assembly Speaker, an incredibly effective politician and leader for Republicans. He's been Speaker since 2013. He's been in the legislature for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so it would be a pretty seismic shift if he didn't run for re-election.
And it was probably going to happen 2 years ago, but they tried to recall him. Remember in 2024, there were opponents of Robin Voss who began this recall effort. Twice they tried to recall and botched both of them. There was a thought from the lobbying corps that Voss was going to retire in 2024. He's done this job for a while. He kept the majority, new maps, you know, all that kind of stuff. So he's probably going to go hang it up and go back to his popcorn business and live life after politics. But he's not going to allow those guys to feel like they forced him out of office. So he ran, you could argue, in spite of his opponents to say, you can't do this, you can't push me out. Well, now, it's 2 years later. Does he want to do this some more? You know, he's got a life. He's on vacation a lot, doing things because he kind of planned to be somewhat retired at this point. And so if you watch these Assembly GOP news conferences, Tyler August, the majority leader, is kind of like piping up more often. He's more inserting himself in conversation because he has been speaker in waiting now for a couple of years. Now, they'd have to win control again in 26 to make him the speaker, but So we call him leader in waiting, I guess. He's kind of like the successor, the heir apparent to Robin Voss. It's been apparent for a while that he's the one being groomed to take over these responsibilities.
And then the other kind of piece of news that we got is that Tom Tiffany has raised $1 million in the very brief period of time since he announced that he will be running for governor on the Republican side of things. And so, again, as we speak about these kind of domino effects, that sets up a kind of – he's setting up a fight for his congressional seat while also kind of continuing to establish himself as potentially the Republican frontrunner for governor.
So $1 million, good number, because big question about Tiffany is, can he raise the money? He had a fundraiser Friday last week with Liz Uihlein, who was a co-host, big mega donor for Republicans. I think she's given $15 million the state, to the GOP candidates and groups since 2010, if I remember correctly. So good ally to have. But there are other big donors out there, and they're kind of like agitating for somebody else. So when you see a Tommy Thompson say, I'm thinking about running for governor, I get the impression in my conversations Tommy's not going to run for governor eventually. But it's a reflection of, he's not happy with the field and doesn't see somebody he thinks can win because Tommy sees problems he wants to have fixed. That's why you keep hearing these names of these businessmen, Eric Hovde, Tim Michaels, Matt Newman, bantied about. It's because they have personal resources. Yes, Tiffany raised $1 million. Great number. Rebecca Clayfish raised $1.2 million in 48 hours when she launched her bid in 2021. So the money is there if you can get excitement. The thing for Tiffany now, people tell me, is can he take the next 2-3 months before the January reports come out to run with this ball and close the door to a Hovde, Michaels, or Newman, say, I've raised $4-5 million. Just picking a number out of thin air, but I've raised this much now. I have this operation going on. It is clear that Tiffany is the front runner for the GOP nomination in the field as configured, but will somebody else get in? And by the way, if you have personal resources, you have until probably this spring. Ron Johnson launched his bid for U.S. Senate in 2010, I think in April of that year. He kind of came out of nowhere, spoke at a Tea Party rally in like March. April he launched his bid. In May, he was backed by the state GOP like it was a rapid-fire succession. And the concern for people I talk to who aren't sure about Tiffany is he doesn't have personal resources. He can't fill that gap. If it's going to be a $50 million price tag for this race, the state GOP has not proven it can raise money the way the Democratic Party can, and Tiffany doesn't have personal resources to fill that gap. Now, the flip side is, Tiffany has a grassroots on his side. Like, he is definitely somebody who's connected to the Trump base. So speaking of Trump, if you get the Trump endorsement between now and spring, that might also like close this door. So that door is a little bit open still for others, but Tom Tiffany's got a chance to close it and kind of secure this thing, the GOP nomination at least, in the coming months.
Well, and actually that kind of speaks to an open question about Democrats too, is again, now that Call isn't joining the governor's race, where does the money that was potentially lined up to kind of back that race, who does that go to now? Mm-hmm. And so we'll also be seeing from Democrats a lot of attempts to court some of that national money that will also certainly be pouring into the state. Speaking of Josh Call, he was also involved in a challenge through the DOJ to a ruling out of Waukesha County Court on Friday. So a judge ruled that the Wisconsin Elections Commission has to verify citizenship status for 3.2 million Wisconsin voters by February. This emerged from an August 2024 lawsuit that asked WEC and the DOT, the Department of Transportation, to kind of cross-check citizenship of all applicants registering to vote. On Monday, the DOJ, Josh Call, called for a stay pending appeal. They argued that essentially this is impossible and that there's also no duty under statute for WEC and DOT to comply with this. The judge did grant that stay, and so we are now waiting for that appeal. Oral arguments will begin in a couple of weeks, October 31st.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Maxwell, in talking to people about his ruling, legal lawyers, they've said they're not sure it's going to survive appeal through the entire process. Why? Well, okay. As you mentioned, he interpreted a responsibility for DOT and WEC to work together on this. There isn't a clear statute that says you shall check everybody's citizenship. Second issue is he didn't make clear, like, what do you have to do to prove citizenship? So right now when you register to vote, you check a box, I am a citizen. If you lie about that, you can be prosecuted. You have to show my birth certificate, my passport, like what is that check going to be? So he has stayed the piece that says you have to show citizenship to register, but he wants the Elections Commission and DOT to keep working with plaintiffs on checking the people already registered. So again, how do you do that? You need to come to my house and like ask to see my pay papers? I mean, it could be flippant, but I'm, you know, there's a challenge there. And the Elections Commission is saying, we can't do that by February. He wants it by the next election. Now, to his point, he's somewhat astonished there's not a mechanism in place to make sure there's nobody who's not supposed to be voting, and he's somewhat stunned this has been taken care of, and they push back to, like, why shouldn't we be doing this? You know, for election integrity people, those, that crowd that is convinced there are all kinds of things wrong with elections, this is a big win for them because they think something amiss with their election rolls, period. But looking forward to the coming appeal process, you've got a liberal Supreme Court majority. DOJ now can choose which appeals court it goes to, because remember the process now in Wisconsin, if you lose in a circuit court, you can pick going somewhere else. I got to bet which appeals court they'll go to, probably one based in Madison. So a challenge to this thing held on appeal. Doubts will be in place for 2026. But, you know, keep an eye on this. And also don't forget the Trump administration, they're pushing for stuff like this. So what's going to happen? Choosing in the end of the Trump administration this going forward.
Well, and the other kind of administrative piece in Wisconsin is that we have same-day voter registration. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing that clerks are saying is that this is actually impossible to comply with the current structure, that it would take years to build out a completely different infrastructure for allowing for registration if you also need to have some sort of verification, you know, not to say what that verification process would be. And so it'll be really interesting to hear those arguments and kind of how that plays out there. And speaking of the nitty-gritty of how we administer rules here, we've been discussing this, the ongoing fallout of this court decision from the summer that basically said that the legislature could not weigh in on how administrative rules are promulgated. This continues to be an issue in the legislature. Republicans who hold the legislature would like more say in that process again after it was kind of taken away from them. And so there was a committee hearing this week on bills that were introduced that would give them a little bit more say-so over the administrative rules process. But those bills were introduced before that decision, and so they were already kind of trying to get some oversight over every 7 years, basically getting to review administrative rules. So we have a little bit of video about the back and forth between Republicans and Democrats on these bills.
I like this bill because it will make JCRER great again. It will be able to have some authority, some role once again.
The Mark Line 2 court case that addressed the current system that found that there were five particulars that were unconstitutional, and it seems to me that this bill brings back at least a couple of those, and that what you're trying to do with this bill is create a new legislative veto. I understand you're trying to make JCRER great again. I think you're making it unconstitutional again.
The legislature needs to have a role in the rulemaking process. And this is one way we thought we could do that to bring some sanity back into this process.
Right. So Republicans arguing that lawmakers should get to reauthorize administrative code every 7 years and have other kind of say-so over the process. And Democrats are saying, no, we now know that that's not constitutional.
So I have seen several attempts by Republicans to basically write the code, rewrite the code, cut the code since they kind of took over in the wave of 2010. Each time they've gone, this is a really big task and we're not experts in it. And during the hearing this week, Nalin and Steve Noss, the co-chair of the Joint Committee of Review Administrative Rules, kind of got at that. Like, we should rely on these bureaucrats who know the rules to kind of like go through them and see which ones we need. And so this process would be every seven, so you, the JCRA would set a deadline. So, okay, in 2 years is your window. You're going to have to come back and justify everything to renew it for another 7 years. Then the agency would go through the rules, flag ones, JCRA would look at it, and that kind of thing. It'd be a huge task. They're also trying to figure out how do you make that constitutional with the Supreme Court ruling. Remember, the bill came out in May. So Nalin said during this hearing, yes, we have to figure out how do we get this to work with the Supreme Court ruling. I don't get the impression that Democrats are going to go get on board with this thing. Now, the flip side is, at some point in this process, will you have a democratically controlled legislature and a Republican governor, and they're unhappy about his or her rules? Maybe. I mean, honestly, if you have a Republican governor, it's unlikely to have Democrats in control of either or both houses. So I mean, not worried about it, like, hey, we're not going to have a role anyway. But this is definitely a change in the process where for years, the legislature had some say in it, and some would argue they went too far. During the lame duck session in 2018, after Scott Walker lost, they went and kind of added layers to the rules process, gave this indefinite suspension power to JCR. Basically, the committee could put a rule on hold with no deadline in sight. They went too far, some will say, and that's what led these court decisions. But Republicans are going, hey, we really should have a say in this because we are the policymaking body, not the bureaucrats. We are. We're like to do that. Not sure they get very far in this process, though.
And they're trying to argue, you know, wait until the shoe is on the other foot, but it doesn't seem like Democrats are terribly concerned about that at the moment, although they do say that they are going to take over the legislature next year. The Assembly has also been pretty busy. They were in session this week, and they passed a slate of housing-related bills that moved pretty quickly. They were just in committee just a little while ago, and some of them passed with bipartisan support, although Democrats said the process itself wasn't bipartisan enough. They pointed to, you know, other bipartisan housing bills that were passed 2 years ago and said that was sort of the right process. We were kind of shafted this time around, and so we'll take a look at some debate from that process right now.
These bills were half-baked last week, and despite a number of recommendations and amendments, they are still not fully cooked. There are some good things in these bills that may help create some additional housing, but we could have done so much more. Democrats offered our ideas in committee, and again, to the credit of the chair and a few brave Republican committee members, they listened and voted with reason and thoughtful consideration. It actually allowed us to make one of these bills better. It's also unfortunate that before we got to the floor today, there was a substitute amendment to remove one of those amendments from the bill that we worked on together. Now, while there is support for many of these bills on our side, we are by no means satisfied, and we are not done fighting until affordable housing isn't the exception, but it's the expectation.
See, this short and very simple bill merely states that the new commercial building code will be implemented on April 1st, 2026. Because the Department of Safety and Professional Services arbitrarily implemented a new date for the building code, this has created confusion amongst many of our partners here in the state. Some of the plans for commercial buildings have been in process for months, sometimes years. And it's not fair to them, and it makes no sense for why they should have to go back to the drawing board and redo their plans to comply with the new building code that was just arbitrarily implemented.
Right, so Penderman there talking about housing code, and or building code rather, and we'll come back to that in a moment. But first, let's talk about that frustration from Democrats that Haywood was talking about, where he basically said this process wasn't right. There was a dispute over housing cooperatives that I think really spoke to that dispute.
So there's one bill that would provide grants to convert things to family housing, essentially multifamily housing. And Ryan Clancy, who is a Democratic socialist from Milwaukee, got an amendment added to the bill that would apply to co-ops. Steve Noss, a state senator from Whitewater, sent an email last week, very unhappy about this change. I think he used some words like comrades in it, mocking his Assembly GOP colleagues for allowing the socialist to get a change to the bill. So before they went to the floor, they announced they're going to pull that piece out. Rob Brooks, who is a Republican and kind of co-authored that legislation, said, we did some more research, figured we kind of would work financially, so we took that piece out. We might address it later on, but not right now. So just an example of where there was a Democratic amendment that was added but then pulled off. Now, another Dem amendment was added. Lori Palmieri from Oshkosh, she got an amendment on that bill. So they did hear ideas, but when you have splits like this on the votes, it doesn't bode well what's going to happen with the governor because he wants bipartisanship. So we'll see if these things become law.
Some of them did pass with voice votes and did get some Democratic sign on, and quite a lot of it was kind of, again, nitty-gritty, these tweaks to zoning changes, to tax incremental financing. They approved loan programs for starter homes, more support for ADUs, or in-law suites is what they're called, where I'm from. And then there was that push that Penderman alluded to over building codes, and so Republicans want to delay the enforcement of the new commercial building code, or new-ish, I should say, building code, so that existing projects don't have to kind of retroactively comply with it. And of course, again, this comes out of this administrative rules. That decision that came out over the summer, it was kind of marketed as being about conversion therapy, but actually it was like the building code was named in this Supreme Court case. And so that is kind of at the heart of this dispute. So Penderman wants that to go into place in April. DISPA says, you know, they've already moved the deadline once, and that building projects that submit their plans before November 1st can still add on to their building plans in compliance with the old building code. So they are saying that arbitrary is kind of in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah, and this code is, I think, patterned after a federal code that took effect in 2021, if I was drafted in 2021, and it was suspended for 2 years by the Joint Committee for Revenancy of Rules. So it's been in the works for a while. But yeah, they're realizing, okay, it's going to happen. How do we implement it? And the builders are saying it's going to increase costs, cause issues for us. They want as much time as possible to delay it. That's why you're seeing this bill.
Democrats this week also introduced a series of bills of their own relating to higher ed, and there were a couple that were specifically kind of aimed at changes that came out of the Walker administration, and so they kind of continue to, I think, project what they might do if they were to, again, take power in the legislature. So some of those would extend collective bargaining rights to UW system faculty, staff, and employees. It would restore previous tenure protections for UW faculty that were done away with under the Walker administration. They also want to offer a tuition promise kind of guarantee for students, in-state students who attend non-Madison UW campuses, and to give more money for sort of student retention and development at UW campuses. And of course, this comes as Republicans and Democrats are kind of consistently at odds over what to be doing with higher ed and the UW system.
This is not going anywhere legislatively this session. This is the queuing up of the issues for next fall that they're going to run on, and then you would see if Democrats have full control in 2027. These are things you'd see them try to do.
Yeah, and so we will continue to see, again, sort of some of that political maneuvering in that way. And similarly, speaking of here we go again, a new PFAS proposal from Republicans was in committee this week. And so, again, this was an attempt to protect innocent landowners from the GOP. State regulators say that that essentially lets polluters off the hook.
So PFAS, they're trying to figure out what is this fine line of, like, somebody who wasn't their fault that they have contamination on the property versus somebody who intentionally or maybe knowingly did this. A good example is like biosolids, okay? There are PFAS in biosolids for a long time. Farmers are getting this and using it to spread in their fields. So the question has been, well, will they be protected from having to clean this stuff up? Because they didn't know. They got this from like the local municipality. Like, should they be blamed, right? Republicans keep saying, we are to protect all these people. So they're not on the hook for this cost because it wasn't their fault. The governor keeps saying, you guys are spreading this definition too wide and catching people that you could argue maybe had some knowledge of what's going on. We're worried that you're going to, you know, protect people you shouldn't be protecting. We've been going this for like, what, 2 years now, three? Until there's a deal between Republicans and the governor, it's not going anywhere. That's the bottom line. I mean, Wimberger has been pushing this bill hard, saying the governor's wrong. He was wrong to veto the 125 or the last round of it. There's $125 million in the last budget to pay for all this. They keep pointing fingers. If you can't reach a deal, you can't get it done. That's the bottom line. And so at some point, we're getting to, you know, mid-October now. There's only like until mid-February if they're going to leave the session. It might be a deal of, okay, who wins next fall? And can new players get something done? Because this has shown no progress. Again, now, they reach a deal, different story. But until there's a deal, maybe we're out of luck.
And, you know, sort of hovering in the background here is the fact that we are discussing these assembly proposals. The assembly has been meeting. The Senate hasn't met since July, and it's sort of unclear when they will reconvene and what they will take up when they do.
We've only heard that they're probably on the floor on next week, so but we're waiting for a calendar. Love to have one.
And that takes us to the stock report. So we also got some news this week that Lisa Neubauer will be retiring from the 2nd District Court of Appeals. That is Assembly Minority Leader Greta Neubauer's mother. She was previously a liberal candidate for the state Supreme Court, and she will be leaving that position.
Which makes Anthony Lococo's quest for the 2nd District that much easier because, you know, I mean, beating an incumbent is never a cakewalk, even if the district is kind of in your favor. Now, Neubauer, she pulled her out of a hat in 2020 politically. So when she ran in 2019 against Brian Hagedorn, she knocked him for ties he had to a Christian school that had policies banning students and faculty from engaging homosexual behavior, I believe it was. Conservatives, that was like the rallying cry to help Hagedorn win that race. Then they pledged, we're going to go get Lisa Neubauer when she runs for election in 2020 in the appeals court. Well, in 2020, she got a criminal defense attorney as her opponent. She outspent him 3.5-1, and she had a primary for president going on that boosted Democratic turnout. Republicans had no reason to go vote because Donald Trump was going to be the nominee, right? So that helped her win by 8 points. That was not going to happen this spring. Despite that, it wasn't why she left. People told me she's 68, I think. She wants to retire, go live like life, and not be in office forever. Now, for Lococo, she's always got to watch now is, will he get any more challengers from the right? Anybody else conservatives get in? He doesn't have any judicial experience. It's a big deal running for appeals court and Supreme Court. That could be a knock against him, but like Jennifer Doro ran for Supreme Court a couple of years ago. She's endorsed Lococo. Judge Maxwell, who we talked about with the citizenship check decision, he's endorsed Lococo. So it seems like he's kind of like solidified that support, that conservative lane. For liberals, can you find somebody to run? in this district, which last year, or sorry, this spring, Bradshaw lost by 10 points statewide in Wisconsin, right? He won the second district by 10 points. So that shows you, even a bad year for a conservative, the second's pretty darn good for you. And we're going to have a Supreme Court race next year that'll drive turnout, but still a tough task for a liberal to win that seat with the way it's configured.
And mixed this week, we have the GOP field for the 7th Congressional District. So we talked about Tom Tiffany and the kind of, again, domino effects of him departing that district.
Yeah, a couple names are not going to run now. Calvin Callahan, a Republican lawmaker from Tomahawk, told me he's not going to. We got too much unfinished business legislature. We talked about Jesse Eben before. She is the one who's in. But the tension now is turning to Mary Felskowski, state senator, and Michael Alfonso, who is Sean Duffy's son-in-law. This could be a real test of, is it what you know or who you know that matters in the Trump world for Republicans? The what you know, Mary Felskowski is 62 years old, owns an insurance agency, been in the legislature for a dozen years, rose into Senate president. She's served. People know who she is. Michael Alfonso is, I think, 24 or 25. He just joined X in August. His most recent job on his LinkedIn profile, which has been deleted. So I wrote about him last week first that he was going to look at running, deleted LinkedIn profile. He was listed as a producer on Dan Bongino's radio show. He's not really well known, other than he's Sean Duffy's son-in-law, who, by the way, has a direct line to Donald Trump. So let's play this game this out. If Alfonso gets in, which all indications are he is, if he gets endorsed by his father-in-law and by Donald Trump, is that the 800-pound gorilla in a primary that outweighs Felskowski connections? Will there be super PACs who pop up in this race to try and help either candidate? That district is tough because you've got, it's 24 counties. You have TV in Green Bay, Wausau, Rhinelander, Duluth, and a little bit of Minneapolis as well. So it's not, you know, cheap. Felskowski's raised money before, but can she raise enough to like get on TV state district wide? She's known in her district, but that district is like one piece of this massive, you know, area. Oh, Alfonso, by the way, his age, which I don't want to diminish his age at all, but the 7th is known for being a youthful district, right? A little bit older. Well, those voters go, wait a second, I've got ties older than you are. Like, how am I going to vote for you? I'm just saying, like, he's going to have to win people over. But if you have Trump endorsing you, and I'm not predicting anything, but you can see the path of like how he'd run this race and what would happen to help him get there. So watch for Alfonso to announce soon. Watch as Felskowski gets in. And then with Jesse Eben, you know, she moved to the district. She ran for the 3rd in 2020. Got Club for Growth as an endorsement, which is a good thing in Republican primary, especially because they do conduit donations. So if they support you, they'll direct their donors to your campaign. That will help her. But she also signed that Walker recall we talked about before. That could be a big problem for her in that primary. So the pieces are kind of falling into place. There are a couple of people to watch if they're going to get in. If we have a 4, 5, 6 person primary, it's going to be interesting to watch those lanes we talked about and how people shake out.
And then following this week, we have Democratic Senator Tim Carpenter.
So Tim is known for being very passionate in how he represents his district and how he makes his arguments. At times, though, he crosses a line. And crossed that line this time, got him pulled off of committee. Came out like late Friday last week that Lemahieu had pulled him off. Devin Lemahieu, the Senate leader, had pulled him off a committee because this is the one where he was in a committee hearing about a bill that would bar the use of public money for health care for people out here legally. During the debate, he reached across the table to grab Chris Kapich's gavel. That's a no-no. All right. Now, Carpenter's got a history of doing things before. I remember back in 2003 during a debate in the budget, he ripped the microphone out of the rostrum. Senate president or Senate clerk, chief clerk was reading the roll call off of and slammed on the desk of the majority leader at the time. So again, sometimes he crosses the line. This one, he got a penalty, got pulled off the committee. Now it's not the worst thing in the world, you're not on a committee, but it does like limit what he can do to shape legislation or make his arguments before he's on the floor of the Senate.
All right, and that'll do it for us at Rewind This Week. I am Anya Van Wagton Donk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
And we will see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.